Good morning. Take the time you need to get settled there. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A23-0631, State of Minnesota versus Timothy Allen Amaker. And if I mispronounce that name, please correct me.
That's great.
Thank you. As you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium is adjustable, and you can see the time remaining in your argument on the clock on the podium. So, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I am here this morning representing the appellant, Mr. Timothy Amaker. Mr. Amaker has raised 4 issues for this court's consideration, and our primary request for relief is that you reverse the conviction on count 1, aiding and abetting attempted murder, and reverse and remand for a new trial on count 2, aiding after the fact. Turning to the first issue, Your Honors, which is that the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Amaker aided and abetted the attempted murder because these circumstances proved failed to eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that Colleen Larson, the shooter, acted alone. The state's theory at trial was that Mr. Amaker would, quote, go to any lengths, and respondent's theory on appeal is similarly that Mr. Amaker would, quote, stop at nothing. This is rhetoric. This is not evidence. And the evidence falls short of the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Respondent also claims that there was a calculated plan, and I agree. But again, the evidence fails to eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that it was Colleen Larson's plan. There is a single piece of evidence the state can point to before the shooting occurred that has any resemblance to Mr. Amaker's involvement. One piece of evidence, one circumstance proved, that is him changing his license plate. I am not aware of any aiding and abetting attempted murder or aiding and abetting murder cases where the conviction has been affirmed on such thin evidence. In fact, if you look at a lot of the aiding and abetting cases are cited on our brief, so this is Gatson, this is Flowers, this is Dominguez-Ramirez, things like transporting the principal to the scene, communicating with the principal or the victim immediately before the offense. Most of the time, the aider and abettor is there, is present for the murder. Of course, none of those things are required. But when you look at this case in comparison to the sort of body of case law, the body of aiding and abetting case law, it becomes dramatically apparent that this case fell short. Another oddity about this case, and I started wondering as I was preparing for this argument, is that the dual charges of aiding and abetting an attempted murder and aiding after the fact. I got curious about how common that practice is. What I found is it's actually quite rare. In the state of Minnesota, appellate cases, published or unpublished, precedential or unprecedented, there are maybe 10 or 15 cases where both of these counts are charged. Now, we don't need to speculate about why that may or may not be, but does it have any meaning here? And this is what I would suggest to this court. In this case, the state used the exact same evidence to prove both counts. Now, certainly, in closing, the prosecutor very clearly walked the jury through acts that could be aiding after the fact. That's true. But, of course, they also used all of that post-shooting conduct to attempt to prove that Mr. Amaker knew the shooting was going to occur and intended to aid it, did something to intend to aid it. But we also know, as a matter of law, and this is in the Leija case discussed by both parties, the Minnesota Supreme Court has actually said the same thing in a case called Flowers, is that as a matter of law, you can't be guilty of both of these crimes. You just can't. That's what our courts have said. So here you have the state prosecuting a person for both crimes, knowing that he can't be guilty of both crimes, on the same evidence. I would submit that that should be concerning to this court.
So in In reviewing the aiding and abetting crime under the circumstantial evidence standard, you would agree that we look at the totality of the circumstances proved?
Of course, Your Honor.
And in your brief, I think you suggest that the circumstances after the shooting do not prove what he knew and what he did beforehand. But it seems to me that the circumstance of him looking at his phone while he's talking to the police or while he was at the police station and the surveillance video being deleted during that time frame, if I'm remembering correctly, that could be relevant to the aiding and abetting charge, even though it happened after, because at that point, you know, it doesn't appear that he had, based on the record before us, that he had communicated with his girlfriend. So would you agree that that circumstance proved is relevant to the analysis?
Of course it's relevant, Your Honor, but it's not determinative for a few reasons. One, by that point, he knew that Nicole Lenway had been shot. The officers had informed him. So what we don't have here, that fact does not eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that he is covering for her. He may have known immediately that Colleen Larson was the shooter.
But and how would he know the time frame to delete on the from the home video?
Sure. Well, I think the problem with our record, Your Honor, is we don't know what he did on his phone. We don't know how long he was looking at his phone. He may have gone through each video and looked at it, found the incriminating videos, and then deleted them. There's no suggestion that he knew the time frame in advance. Certainly, that's not proven by any circumstance.
Right. I guess I'm inferring that from the circumstances.
I think, sure. So I think the, I guess I'm trying to phrase this correctly. It is a reasonable inference that while he was in an interview room at the police station, Mr. Amaker used his phone and deleted incriminating videos. There's no doubt about that. But that doesn't disprove that he's covering for Colleen. Everything he does, even starting immediately upon his knowledge that the shooting occurred, is to cover for her. Again, the state has to show not only that he knew in advance the shooting was going to happen, but that he did something to intend to aid it before it happened. And that is what is lacking here.
Isn't there, so to that point, you agree that even under the heightened standard, we start first by resolving any conflicting evidence in terms of determining the circumstances proved. We resolve that in favor of the verdict.
Right? You do, Your Honor.
So we have the testimony that Ms. Larson didn't own any guns and she didn't know where your client stored the guns, right? And we have the testimony that your client denied owning a .380 caliber firearm, but the police later found an empty .380 firearm at the residence and discharge casings at the residence at your client's house. And the discharge casings at the scene were determined to be fired from the same gun that fired the discharge cartridge casings found at your client's residence. So obviously, Ms. Larson got the gun she used to shoot Ms. Lenway before she shot Ms. Lenway.
Yes.
So we have her testimony, Ms. Larson's testimony, that she didn't know where he kept the guns.
I have to correct, Your Honor. We don't have any testimony from Ms. Larson. She doesn't testify at trial. None of her statements
come
in.
But we have evidence that Ms. Larson doesn't know where.
Here, can I think I can help. The only place in the record that exists is in my client's statement. So I am not
So we would still resolve that in favor of the verdict, though, in your client's statement, that Ms. Larson.
Sure. So he, I think it is fair to say he distances himself from this act in any number of ways. Yes, he says the words, she didn't know where the guns were. Do you know where they found the empty gun box? In an open kitchen cabinet. It was not hidden. She lived there. She's an adult woman. All we know is that, I think it's a reasonable inference that the gun came from the house. She lives there just as well as he does. She took his truck. She drove his truck to the scene of Family Wise and back.
But the standard still requires us to construe the fact that he says that she doesn't know where the guns are stored in favor of the verdict, right?
Well, that's true, Your Honor.
And that she didn't own any guns in favor of the verdict, right? So the idea then is, isn't it that this is something that was needed for the crime, that the reasonable inference, it's very difficult when you connect the chain to get away from the fact that he would have supplied the gun to her before the shooting.
I disagree, Your Honor. Even if you take that statement as fact, even though we know he told many untruths and the state charged him for telling untruths in that statement, if you isolate that one and believe it's true, it doesn't mean she can't go find them. They were either underneath beds or in literally open kitchen cabinets. She's average height. She is a sighted person, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic. She could literally find them in the home. She knows he owns many, many guns. Again, it doesn't eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that she had this plan. She had her own motive. And in fact, we know without a doubt, one thing we know without a doubt, she found a gun, whether it was given to her, she found it of her own volition. She got in a vehicle. She drove to where she knew Nicole Lenway would be. She lay in wait. She ambushed her, and she shot her multiple times and then fled. She did all of that on her own.
Well, his testimony that she didn't know where the guns, where he kept his guns, that could also go to support the theory you were just arguing, which is he's covering for her.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, the state points that out to the jury in closing, the number of times, again, per the state's argument, that he supposedly lied in his statement. They use that to charge him with aiding after the fact. So the state is trying to have it both ways. You charge him with those untruths. You say those untruths are a crime, but also want to believe isolated portions of his statement. At a minimum, it again shows the really odd discord in this prosecution. And another place that's evident is in the relationship evidence issue.
Counsel, before you move on.
Of course.
So when we look at the intentionally aids element,
yes,
we can take into account the close relationship between the principal offender and the person who's been charged with aiding. Is that accurate?
Of course.
Okay. And we do have a situation here where they were together, that the data both from the vehicle and the cell phones of these two individuals shows that they were together right up until about 2 hours before the shooting occurred.
That's true, Your Honor.
Okay. Moving in tandem, et cetera. And then I think another piece we look at is the lack of objection or surprise. And it seems that the record shows that when informed that the shooting had occurred, your client was not surprised, that he, in fact, started to go into his usual discussion about allegations of child sexual abuse and, a number of other things. So I don't see you disagreeing that those are things we take into consideration. So going back to what Judge Cochran raised about the totality of the circumstances, we look at all of that, and we look at the information about the 380 cartridge casings, and we look at the issues with the license plate and the Superman decals, et cetera. So how do you overcome, then, the totality?
Sure.
Of these circumstances.
So I'd like to make two responses, because I actually would like to address the lack of surprise. This argument is a new theory on appeal. This is not something the state emphasized at trial. I'm not saying it wasn't there, but it wasn't emphasized. What is odd is that there is no love lost between these two people. It is an incredibly acrimonious relationship. I know that's obvious from the transcripts. Does he express surprise? I don't know. He neither sounds aghast, or he doesn't say anything nasty about her. He doesn't say, I'm glad, or something terrible. And in fact, he ultimately says, is everyone okay? His point, which I think is a fair one, is what the police do not tell him is, Nicole Lenway was just shot. That is not what they say. They say something like, your ex was involved in a shooting. Again, if you presume an innocent person, would they ask follow-up questions? Yes, probably. But do they immediately know that she's fighting for her life? That is not what he was told. It is not as damning as it seems on its face. But to turn to the totality, even if you take that fact, and if you take it as his worst in support of the verdict, it's not just in the totality of the circumstances, is there an inference of guilt? Of course there is. That is why we're here. I do not need to disprove to this court that there is a reasonable inference of guilt. Instead, what you need to consider is whether there is a reasonable alternative hypothesis consistent with innocence. And there is. So it's not that there isn't all of that evidence against him. The question is, taking it at its full weight, does the possibility still exist that Colleen Larson acted alone? And we would say
yes. But not
yes.
any possibility.
A reasonable possibility.
A reasonable possibility.
Absolutely. And again, the only thing that suggests his involvement before the shooting is the license plate. There are a whole bunch of reasonable explanations for that one fact, and I can find no case with one fact indicating aid before a shooting or before a murder. There's usually a lot more, which again is not the reason, but is sort of poses the question of the weakness of the evidence in this case. The fact that there is no other case like it, that this case is unusual, that this case was motive. This case was a strong assumption. This case was, we think he must have done this. This case was, jury, look at how much he dislikes this woman. Come on, he must have done it. That is not enough. That is not sufficient evidence. My time is waning. I don't think I have sufficient time to cover the relationship evidence, so I will return to that on rebuttal and ask your honors to reverse the conviction for aiding and abetting attempted murder. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I think the evidence is pretty clear that Mr. Amaker was going to stop at nothing until he took and removed Ms. Lenway from his child's life. I don't think that there was anything nefarious in charging both aiding an offender beforehand and after the fact, and I'm surprised at the reference to 10 to 15 such cases. I'm not aware of that in the brief. If that is, I must have missed it. Additionally, we only have certain cases that we see on appeal, so there might be other cases in which that's not even appealed. I'd also note that in the land of exoneration claims now, it's more common to actually charge more offenses than you necessarily would need to so as to avoid a claim of actual innocence down the line if you didn't allege some nefarious conduct. Here, I think it's important as I believe Judge Wheelock, you noted they were together leading up to the offense. This isn't just an instance where they needed to communicate via cell phone. In fact, the lack of communication afterwards is a little startling as well. From 8 to 10 p.m., he's been informed that the mother of his child has been shot, and he doesn't contact his partner to let her know.
Well, was he actually informed that the mother of his child was shot? Or my recollection is similar to Appellant's counsel recollection that he was informed that she was involved in a shooting.
Your Honor, it changes a bit over time. So initially, I'm going to turn you to page 11 of my brief where I cite to the record, Exhibit 7 is the video, the body cam footage of the interaction with him initially. When the officers first speak to him inside family-wise, they tell him, your ex-partner was involved in a shooting right outside here. They don't say there was a shooting. Your ex-partner was involved in a shooting. He immediately responds that he's been inside. He's making sure that his alibi is crystal clear and that he's not going to go downtown with the police and goes on to the usual claims that he'd been making about the problems with Minneapolis police. Then he says, I don't know what this has to do with me. He does ask a few minutes later if everybody okay, but he doesn't ask about Miss Lenway. He does go downtown. He has his phone the entire time. I think it's just important to note that, yes, this was acrimonious and there was no concern at all for Miss Lenway, but there's also no concern to find out should anyone be going to the hospital, where is my child, what's happening, things of that nature. Between 8 and 10 p.m. after he's in the interview with the police and they're telling him a little bit more and they've expanded, that was the word I was looking for, they've expanded on the circumstances of what happened, he doesn't reach out to Miss Larson. He doesn't want to check anything. Instead, he's looking at his phone and he's looking at the videos. Why would he be looking at the videos at the house unless he knows what he's looking for?
Was that proven that he was looking at the videos?
It's not proven.
We just know it was deleted from the phone, right? But not what he was actually looking at during that time.
It's a reasonable inference that he was looking at the videos because of the fact that the three blank cameras they align with his email address and with his cell phone. And during the time that he was in the interview with police, two videos were deleted. They were the videos from 7:14. Excuse me, that's not correct. 7:13 and 7:40 p.m.
I mean, isn't the bigger problem the whole idea of the rational hypothesis that points to not guilty on this count, being that he could have realized right away, as soon as being told that, Ms. Larson did this. And he's, you know, he's covering for her with the videos, he's covering for her with his lack of surprise. Everything that he's doing is aiding an offender after the fact. So why should we conclude that that's not a rational hypothesis?
I think because that's looking at, respectfully, Your Honor, that's looking at the circumstances piecemeal. When you look at the circumstances as a whole, and as your question was earlier, you you look at each instance and it goes in favor of the state, in favor of deference to credibility determinations, assuming that the state's witnesses were believed, defense witnesses, and were disbelieved, that the jury can accept part and reject part of a testimony, and you disregard evidence inconsistent with the verdict. That all inferences in favor of the verdict. And I think looking at them piecemeal is doing the opposite, especially because if you look at McAllister, which is a case talking about how you can infer the state of mind based on the presence at the scene, the close association with the principal before or after, the lack of objection, lack of surprise, I just don't think it's reasonable to think he just realized in that moment. It's quite a coincidence if all of a sudden his partner is taking his truck, which the day earlier he's like, oh, the license plates were stolen. I need a temporary plate. Says he reported it to police, but there's no corroboration of a police report. And then the next day puts on these Superman tags, is telling the police in the interview when he sees a photo, that's not my truck. It has a big thing here. It's got a big Superman logo. It's got a big GT on the side. He's saying all of these things. I don't think that it's simply aiding after the fact. I'm unaware of any case that says everything has to be done beforehand in order to aid and abet an individual in committing a crime.
Are there any specific circumstances that you would point us to that would support your position that it was aiding and abetting, not after the fact, but before or during, beyond what opposing counsel has conceded with regard to the license plate, temporary license plate?
The empty gun case for the 386 hour, the fact that, I mean, I know that the gun case was found in the cabinet, but he says that he gave the gun to Ms. Lenway. That's not true. She denies that at trial. The bullets that are fired match. The gun is somehow missing after the fact. I think it's looking at it in the context. I don't think that it necessarily has to be beforehand. There's not a reasonable hypothesis here that this individual, who is a young woman who's in a relationship with him, decided on her own to go about taking out the mother of his child. I don't think that's a reasonable inference. If you look at the totality of the evidence, and it's just too much of a coincidence. And I think that's not reasonable. And I think that the state doesn't have to prove beyond all doubt. It's beyond all reasonable doubt. The fact that you have the timing, location, that they're always together, they're in tandem, he's with the truck, he's always with the truck, then all of a sudden...
Yes? I'm sorry, you finished.
Oh, no.
Is there any evidence in the record as to whether Ms. Larson had her own vehicle?
There was...
Drove a different vehicle?
I believe she had access to the Jeep, which is the vehicle that he takes to the family-wise that day. So they kind of swap vehicles at that point. The use of the truck, I think that also goes to the fact that he was aware of what was happening, why all of a sudden he would take the Jeep this time to go to family-wise. I simply, in looking at the record as a whole, I don't believe that this is a case where there is a reasonable inference supporting innocence here. I think the jury realized that when they took 75 minutes to reach a verdict. They sat through almost a month of testimony, 14 trial days, heard all of it, and quickly concluded that appellant aided and abetted Colleen Larson in trying to kill the mother of his child. His behavior aligns with that. It's my understanding from counsel that she's going to address the relationship evidence. I believe everything is sufficiently outlined in the brief, but I would want to point out that with regard to the relationship evidence, some of it also came in as relevant evidence rather than relationship evidence. I believe that was with regard to Mr. Ford. That should be noted in my brief. Also, I would point out to this court with regard to the reference made.
Only with regard to Mr. Ford that it was admitted let me rephrase it. So I think appellant points to a number of different pieces of evidence.
Yes.
And argue that appellant argues were should not have been admitted as relationship evidence. Are you suggesting that only the evidence relating to Mr. Ford was admitted as relevant evidence and not relationship evidence, that all of the other evidence here was admitted as relationship evidence?
Your Honor, I apologize if I was unclear there. Part of the evidence was admitted as relationship evidence, but then I believe Judge Ascolani also noted that she found it to also be relevant.
Okay.
And so I'm not saying that it was just limited, but I do not believe that the evidence with regard to Mr. Ford necessarily was admitted as relationship evidence. I think that Judge Ascolani tried to clarify that. I think that the district court did not abuse its discretion with regard to admitting this evidence, and I would point this court to prior decisions in which photographs, even the argument that took place beforehand, when photographs are being used to establish relationship evidence, that wasn't the case here. The voluminous nature of it is not so prejudicial that it would overwhelm the jury. It's not so substantially prejudicial that it would improperly be used. The district court gave the appropriate limiting instruction, and I do not think the district court abused its discretion here. With regard to the charging or seeking sentencing for aiding and abetting an offender in an attempted murder and aiding an offender after the fact, I will tell the court the prosecutor did not know that they could not convict on both. They were intending to seek consecutive sentences and then couldn't when they realized about Leha. And so I just want to point out to the court this was not anything nefarious trying to establish something here to get a conviction with improper evidence before the court. That's not at all the case. Unless there are further questions, I would rest on my brief and ask that this court reject each of appellant's arguments and affirm.
Can I ask you a question about Leha and
yes.
What you would advise we do with count two if we reverse the conviction and remand with instructions to vacate? Do you agree that the count should remain unadjudicated, then count two should remain unadjudicated upon the court correcting the warrant of commitment and vacating? Or is it that as a matter of law, the conviction should be reversed completely?
That's a great question. I think with the way that Mensis kind of controls what can or can't be entered by the district court, my understanding, I think that you'd have to make it unadjudicated because I don't think it would be reversed.
Because if something you were referring earlier to, exonerations, if something later were to happen with count one,
yes,
count two would still be legally viable. It's just that you can't be guilty of both. That's
exactly, and that would be my concern. And I say that partly because I do some exonerations. So I do think that it's important to not reverse it outright because there hasn't been a claim that there is insufficient evidence for that or that that should not have been convicted. I do know that there is the issue with regard to the jury instructions. I again posit that they were fine, but if for some reason this court is simply going to rule that as a result of the conviction on count one, you cannot also convict on count two, I think this court does not need to address that issue with the jury instructions and would just send instructions to the district court to vacate the adjudication of guilty.
Although that would, this is similar, I know you were here for the last argument, that that issue is fully briefed on unanimity, and that would leave, that would not foreclose that challenge from later being raised by Mr. Amaker.
That's true, Your Honor. And so if this court wished to address it, that would also be fine. I do believe that it's sufficient with the fact that if you look at the language of the statute, it's listed as alternatives. It's or. It's not and. And so I don't think that there's a unanimity problem with that.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. There is a unanimity problem because that's misconstruing our argument. Of course, there's alternatives in the statute. That's a means argument. Here, there's eight acts presented to the jury. But Your Honor is correct. If you affirm the conviction on count one, you have to vacate the conviction on count two. But I think you leave it unadjudicated. There's no problem with the jury's verdict. It's just the conviction. I'd like to go back to basic principles on count one because I believe I heard Ms. Luan say that she's not aware of any case or any authority that says the state has to prove for aiding and abetting that the aider and abetter did something before the crime. I may have misheard, and forgive me if I did. That is absolutely untrue. That is a very basic principle of aiding and abetting liability because you have to have foreknowledge knowledge that the person is going to or is currently committing the crime, and you have to intend to aid the crime before it happens, or during, right? Of course, during. There are aiders and abettors that aid a crime while it's happening. Getaway driver, classic example, right? But there is, of course, there's law that says you have to do something beforehand. That's all of the statutes and the cases on aiding and abetting liability.
What about his presence at the family-wise? I mean, by having the... I mean, isn't an inference that can be drawn from the timing of when this occurred that there was planning that went into so it occurring at family-wise because that would assure that Ms. Lenway would be there?
Again, that's one inference. Another is that Colleen Larson knew that my client would be busy and have an alibi. And if she's trying to do this of her own volition for her own motive, there's no reason to think she wouldn't do it. She knows where Ms. Lenway is going to be as well. In fact, there's plenty of evidence in this record that Ms. Larson often picks up the child. Ms. Larson knows exactly what their schedule is. The problem with the state's argument here is these crimes become the same. If you can prosecute someone for aiding and abetting the completed crime based only on what they did afterwards, that's aiding after the fact. It makes them synonymous, and I would suggest that's something that we should not do. I have 3 minutes. I'd like to briefly cover the relationship evidence argument. First, I'd like to correct the record because I made a mistake. So my brief argues that all of the evidence we suggest was inadmissible was admitted as relationship evidence. That is true. That's document 93. It's clearly offered under the statute and admitted under the statute. What happens right before Mr. Ford's testimony is Judge Ascalani walks it back, right? Mr. Amaker objects again. Again, the state is still arguing that Mr. Ford is a family or household member because he's Nicole Lenway's family or household member. That's squarely wrong. That's noted in the case law. And the judge realizes it and says, okay, fine, but I'm going to say it's just relevant evidence. So that's true. Our argument remains. 634 has a probative versus prejudice balancing test right in it. We would submit the evidence about Mr. Ford still fails that test. So the argument is the same. But respondent was correct to say that the Ford evidence specifically was admitted eventually as relationship evidence. This court should keep in mind your review is de novo. When you're deciding whether evidence fits under statute 634.20, it's de novo. And these categories of evidence aren't even close. The fact of how his relationship with Ms. Larson started, that's not domestic conduct by anyone. Stuff Colleen Larson did, that is not domestic conduct by Mr. Amaker. Actions by court entities, by the family court, by police agencies finding reports of child abuse to be unsubstantiated, none of that falls under the statute. But that is precisely how it's admitted.
Abuse of discretion, right? Under the alternative theory that Judge Ascalani admitted it, that would be an abuse of discretion because you...
It would. Right, okay. It would. And again, I would say just briefly to cover the prejudice, this is a lot. It's well over 100 pages, and multiple witnesses, Nicole Lenway, Donovan Ford, the detective whose name is escaping me from Burnsville, and the doctor are called almost exclusively to produce relationship evidence. Also, the state says quite clearly that they need it. I was flabbergasted to read this statement in the record when the prosecutor tells the district court judge, if you don't admit this evidence, he's going to win. That is about as clear of a statement of prejudice, meaning it mattered. The state needed it, so the absence of it would have mattered to the verdict. That's essentially a concession that without this evidence, the jury would have acquitted. It's odd, but it's in the record. And to be clear about the cautionary instruction, it is very limited. It is very narrow. The judge instructs the jury, the evidence of the, I forget the exact words, but she's clear that it covers only Nicole Lenway. That, the jury is told, you can't use to find that he's a bad person and so therefore he's guilty. That cautionary instruction does not cover all of the stuff we're suggesting was erroneously admitted. Because don't forget, a lot of this I acknowledge was admissible. All of Ms. Lenway's testimony about her relationship with Mr. Amaker, how it started, how it soured, the times that he allegedly abused her. All of that stuff comes in because it's proper under the statute. But the judge went way past the statute's boundaries here. This is concerningly expansive in terms of the boundaries of the statute.
In your reading of the transcript in terms of the judge walking back the decision on the relationship evidence, is that was only as to the evidence relating to Mr. Ford?
Oh, absolutely. That is abundantly clear. I can give you a page number if you'd like.
Sure. I looked at it. I just... want to revisit it.
I'll just do this quickly. It occurs immediately before his testimony. It is volume 9 of the transcript, which is from 11/15/22. It's the very beginning of that transcript, the very beginning of volume 9.
Okay, thank you.
My time has expired. I would ask your honors to reverse the conviction on count 1. Because of that reversal, to then reverse and remand for a new trial on count 2 because of the instructional error. Thank you so much.
Thank you to both counsel. Your briefs and arguments here today were very helpful. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. That concludes our oral calendar for today.
All rise.